You know, this is one of those sermons that I should have written in the cemetery. It really is. But because of the timing and with what was going on with Chet and the family, it was difficult. And in my mind's eye, though, as I was writing it, I want you to know I saw the graves of people I'd buried. And I heard in my ears their tears falling and their cries of grieving. Friday, we interned Chet at the local cemetery. We placed his ashes in the vault. We put them in there ourselves. And we did that. And then yesterday, we celebrated his life in resurrection hope. And it's interesting that I'm following the church calendar, and I did not choose this text. This text chose us. It chose me. And the Psalms that we read this morning, that's part of the church calendar. There's always the Ecclesiastes, that's part of the church calendar. So we're looking at what the church has told that when we read this gospel text, these other texts need to be incorporated into our thinking. I find it comforting that Christians around the world are being immersed in a text about wealth and thus about death this morning. And thus about the wisdom of Jesus, which I believe we need to think differently on, because I think the wisdom of Jesus is to ask, how little can I live on and not how much can I hoard to live in luxury? It's a totally different question. How little can I live on? It's about security in our current situation. Think about the fact that Christians around the globe are immersed in this text today. So, Mother Teresa's poor in Calcutta, as they go to worship, they're immersed in this text on wealth with us and us with Calcutta's poor. That's haunting. The problem for us is that we live in the most economically prosperous country the world has ever seen. Ever seen. And it is worth asking what the pursuit of wealth has given us. Because we do pursue it. I remember when I taught at the academy for those years. Oh, I would get tired when I would hear students say they wanted to go to college or into the job market just to make a truckload of money. And I would just say, that is meaningless. Absolutely meaningless. We have a higher suicide rate. What has money gotten us? We're violent, we're depressed, we're in a national crisis of depression. Our kids are filled with great anxiety and great fear and great despair. And I don't know how to make that positive. There's things we can do about it. Anybody that works with kids, raises kids, has grandkids, I just want to tell you, you need to read Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. It's a must read. How the great rewiring of childhood is causing an epidemic of mental illness. We think retirement is about me and mine and no more. We travel the world to see things before death, and yet, Carrie said something to me one time, and it's haunted me. She said, Jesus, the resurrected Jesus, tells us we'll live forever through the new creation, and we'll just be able to move about and have our being through the new creation for endless time. She goes, why are we spending so much time running around the world trying to see things? Not a bad question. Our non-Christian goals can be to eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die. Jesus tells us that that's not the Christian goal. That is the message of our text today. And Paul, just remember, Paul places that line, that same thought, at the center of his famous resurrection passage. 1 Corinthians 15. He says, if the dead are not raised, because we're going to be raised to new life and forever, he says, let us eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die. It's right in the resurrection text. What does Jesus say? The rich fool said in the Luke 12 parable, he said, I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry. And Jesus said, God calls that person a word that we should be very hesitant to use, a fool, because death is knocking at the door. Wealth and death. Will we just build bigger barns, or will we ask how little we can live on? Remember, the Son of Man, Jesus, had nowhere to lay his head. If you leave, I have tons of hospice stories, and they often just, I forget them, and then I'm writing something, and it comes back to my mind. This is one of them. I was caring for a man. It was when I was working at the academy, so I was only working at hospice about 20 hours a week at that time. And he lived in Ephrata. His name was Thurman. His primary caregiver was his daughter, Janet. And if you leave the church and you go out and to the hospital and you turn left and you get on that way, you go around, he lived in that neighborhood on your right. His daughter and I were talking at the kitchen table. Thurman was at the far end of the living room. And I want you to know, death was present. I could smell death walking in the house. A heaviness was thick in the air. Mortality was sitting in the corner listening to our conversation. And I mean that literally. I have no problem personifying death, and neither does our scriptures. You know, Psalm 49 was read this morning, and I referred to it at Chet's service yesterday. Like sheep, they are destined for the grave, and death will feed on them, is one translation. The one that we used in our worship this morning is that death will shepherd them. Both translations carry with the same word. It can go either way. Think about that. Death will shepherd them. Or Jeremiah says, death has climbed in through the windows and has entered our fortress. It has cut off the children from the streets and the young men from the public square. Death is personified. And I sense death. Thurman's daughter, Janet, she sensed nothing. Absolutely nothing. My back was to the living room. I hadn't seen Thurman. I hadn't laid my eyes on him because I entered through the back door. If I turned and I looked into the living room from where I was sitting, I would be able to see his feet. That was it. I talked with his daughter for about 20 minutes. And then halfway through our conversation, I sensed that death had walked over to the bed and told Thurman it's time, and he died. It's one of my gifts. I can't explain it. And Carrie, sister, she says, I don't want Mark showing up at my door unannounced. And I mean that. I remember driving in from Ritzville. I had seen a guy the day before, and he was doing well, and he wasn't on my thing, and I had to go way up to Davenport, and I was coming back, and I was in a hurry, and it was like the Spirit of God said, you need to stop and see Melvin. I'm like, get out of there. I'm not going to do that. I just saw him yesterday. I spent an hour and a half with him and his family. The closer I got to his exit, it was like, stop, Mark. And I knocked on the door, and his wife answered, and she says, our family's been sitting around praying you would stop. And he died while I was there. I don't know how it happens. It just does. But I said to Thurman's daughter, Janet, we need to go to your dad's bedside. He has died while we've been talking. I didn't go look first. I said that to her. And her response was, Mark, you haven't even seen him yet. You don't know. And we approached the bed together, and he had died. Death had done his work. Jesus tells us in his story of the rich fool that death calls into question our greed, our covetedness, our coveting hearts. And I want you to notice how Jesus frames selfishness in this story that he tells. What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops, so this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus of harvest, and I'll say to myself, you have a bank account of cash that will last well over 50 years. You need to go chill on a Hawaiian beach, eat freshly caught fish, and drink margaritas while laughing with friends. And Jesus said, you fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. And then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is Jesus' way of asking, who's getting the U-Haul your hearse is pulling? The church tells us to place Ecclesiastes, what Sally read for us this morning, to place Ecclesiastes with this parable. Ecclesiastes, this book of the Bible that tells us that wealth-seeking is a chasing after the wind, and it's meaningless. It will not satisfy, it will disappoint, it will leave us empty, it will leave us frazzled and vacuous. And the word here in the Hebrew is hebel. Hebel. Let's unpack that a bit. It means vapor. It means meaninglessness. Dust in the wind. All we are is dust in the wind. Hebel. Hebel. It means breath. It means futility. And it's used 86 times in the Bible, the whole Bible, this word, hebel. 38 of them are in the book of Ecclesiastes. 8 of them are in Genesis chapter 4. And that's the story of Cain killing Abel. And guess what Abel's name is in Hebrew? Hebel. Just a vapor. Just a vapor. Dust in the wind. Hebel. Abel is a mere breath. This reminds me of Carrie's brother Mark. I talk to Mark every week. He and Debbie, they were building bigger and bigger barns in their life. I mean, they had it all. I mean, they had a beautiful home, large home, and they had a space. And he thought, let's get a piano and put it there. Debbie doesn't play the piano, and Mark is like a half an inch above chopsticks. But they bought it. I mean, they were living the American nightmare. God met him when he was driving on the road, and he had to pull over, and he was weeping. He was empty. He was taking life easy, eating, drinking, having, and being merry. But he was empty, full of regret, and he was wondering, is this why I have been placed on planet Earth? On planet Earth, placed here? I mean, we celebrated Larry Wright's life. He died at 90. The very morning of Larry's funeral, his body was here in the church. I received a call from my good friend Grant, and Grant was coming over to the liquor store that he owns here in Ephrata, and he said, let's get together for coffee. I'd just talk. And I said, you know, I can't. I have to help put Larry Wright in the ground today. And he goes, oh, Larry Wright, the doctor? And I said, yes. And he said, oh, years ago, I had to see him 2 times because Dr. Roth wasn't in, and I had to see him, and he took care of a really important problem in my eye. He said, can I come to the service? I said, no, not really. I said, of course you can come, Grant. He's been here before. And you know what? He loved it. He just loved it. And after the service, he was sitting out there with people and talking. And in front of all these people, he said, you know, this was the best. He says, I need to go to a lot more funerals. This is not a Jesus follower. I need to go to more. And he was speaking ancient wisdom from Ecclesiastes, this book about Hebel. Because in Ecclesiastes 7, it says, it's better to go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting, for death is the destiny of every man, and the living should take it to heart. Hebel. Perspective is gained in seeing the dead and hearing their stories and listening to life's shortness. Life is not about grabbing all you can and padding your 401k so life is cozy. The problem here is that you and I don't think we are greedy. We don't think we covet. I know that when I examine my own heart and examine the heart of others in their acts and values lived, I want you to know that we are filled with greed and covetousness. My heart is greedy. I'm preaching to myself this morning, so please don't think I have anyone in here in my mind. Moses, in Exodus 19, he hikes Mount Sinai, right? We know the story. God meets him there. The Lord descends in fire on top of the mountain. There was thunder and lightning. Smoke billowed up like the smoke coming out of a furnace, and the mountain shook violently. The people saw it, they felt it, and they trembled. And he's given what? The Ten Commandments. And the first commandment is, have no other God before me, right? Before me. The Lord is not saying that no one else can come first, as in serve any God you want, as long as you take care of your obligation to me first. He's not saying that. What this word before means is at my face, in my presence. God doesn't want any other God in his presence. Your loyalty and my loyalty has to be to him. God's attitude about other worship deities is that there is to be none, not at his face. And then the last commandment, that's the first commandment. Then the last commandment is on greed, covetousness, homes, spouses, cars, trucks, motorcycles, the ox and the donkey. And in case we didn't get what God was communicating in the 10th commandment, it ends, or anything that belongs to your neighbor, to the Joneses next door. What frames the 10 commandments? Absolute loyalty to one God and covetousness and greed. Oh, the Big Ten, it talks about sex, no adultery, as in also no coveting your neighbor's wife or husband or your friend's date. But if attention given to a topic places the need for higher warning and consideration, hear this. Verses on greed and money outnumber our scripture's sexual interests many times over. In other words, stop pointing fingers at LGBTQ+ issues and start by looking at our fear of poverty and vulnerability, of what we say is poverty. And get this, the Bible has about 500 verses on prayer that are outnumbered by over 2,000 on money and wealth. Elizabeth Oldfield, she wrote this wonderful book. Tim Barton told me to read it. She wrote it a couple years ago. She's in Britain, and she lives communally, she and her family. She has kids. They decided they needed to learn to live with other people, and so they bought a house together, and they live in as a family. And she talks about what this has done to her pride and how good it has been for her. And it's on the seven deadly sins is her book, Fully Alive, Tending to the Soul in Turbulent Times. And this is what she said. It's on her chapter on greed, Arvas. Jesus in particular seems more interested in money and what we do with it than almost anything else. His teaching is so direct, I can only look at it out of one eye on a day I feel calm. We should keep an eye on greed because it enslaves us while promising freedom. We get literally weighed down by all the crap we own hiding in drawers and cupboards and under beds. But we should also keep an eye on greed, because our greed feeds endemic injustice. It enslaves others. Our greed enslaves others. You know, the Colossians says, in Colossians, Paul says, we're to put to death. We've been put to death in Christ. And so evil desires need to be put to death, and greed, which is idolatry. I love that, because you see, he brings the first commandment and the last commandment together. Greed is idolatry. America is a culture, whether we want to admit it or not, of economic injustices. The late Old Testament scholar Walter Brueggemann, he just died a few months ago, in 90 years old, amazing man, said the people with the greatest political voice are the rich financing the campaigns. They have a greenback voice that outnumbers common folk in the millions. I want you to know that our president this past week lied, that no one has died because of the pulling back of USAID and PEPFAR. No one's died. He says he was on camera, he was on the news. I just want you to know what a big fat lie. This was said at the same time that Francis Collins, PhD, MD, and former director of the National Institute of Health, who served under Obama and President Trump and President Biden. He was on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. They're very good friends. And he says, we have this terrible problem in our culture, and it's a problem of compassion and greed. And he said, but right now, I said just a couple weeks ago that the numbers were at 40,000 children. He said 90,000 children alone we know have died since pulling back those funds. Children, not adults, just children. And he says they have died over things that were so easily treatable. That's what David Brooks says. He says, I have never been so angry over anything in politics than that issue right there. David Brooks is a Christ follower. Tim Keller led him to the Lord. He was in a book club with Tim Keller. And may I remind you, let's look at the character. I'm not even going to go into the character of our president. I would just be too dark. I don't have to. But look at the character of Francis Collins, the late Christopher Hitchens, who was one of the aggressive atheists, the Four Horsemen, said of Francis Collins that he has never encountered a more Christ-like life than Collins in just the way he cared for him during his dying with cancer, because he has died. He and Francis Collins became friends because Collins sought him out. He doesn't hide his faith, Francis Collins, in Jesus Christ. He even still is using the word evangelical. He does it with Stephen Colbert. He walked with the late Timothy Keller through death. He was in a book club with him. He talked to him almost every day. And you know what? They didn't talk about death. They didn't talk about health. They talked about Jesus and the resurrection. As Tim Keller was dying of pancreatic cancer, he had not been able to worship in quite some time, like in church. And so what did Francis Collins do? He took church to the hospital. He gathered all of his friends and family that they couldn't get there, and he led them. Collins is very musical, and he led them in a worship service. You need to know, I don't believe in President Trump over Dr. Collins. 90,000 children. One of the ways he ends his conversation with Stephen Colbert is, we have a compassion problem. We're selfish. Look how this story in Luke 12 opens. Teacher or rabbi, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. I want you to know this is not an unusual request. Teachers and rabbis were to be asked to settle matters in inheritance. This person asking for Jesus' help is walking through the death of his father. His dad didn't provide an oral or written will. This meant the estate was just kind of floating in limbo between two brothers, and this guy that Jesus was talking to is the youngest brother. We know that by just the culture and the story. And he's prodding Jesus to deal with his older brother to give him his inheritance. According to the law, it could not be divided until the older brother decided it was time. This guy wants justice. This man, though, Jesus detects, is covering his greed by wrapping paper of justice. He's making it look like it's a justice issue, but Jesus is reading his heart. He wants his money. This is just the just thing to do. Divide the inheritance. But Jesus sees his heart, hiding his greed in a cloak of goodness, justice. Justice is a central theme of the Bible. It's central to the kingdom of God. It's central to the life of Jesus. It's central to his work and ministry. Luke 4 pictures Jesus walking into the synagogue, and he gets the scroll from Isaiah, and he opens it up and reads, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he's anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom from the prisoners, give sight to the blind, set the oppressed free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." What is he saying? Love justice. Love mercy. Walk humbly with your God. Amos. We see Jesus willing to spend time with the rich in the Gospels. Yes. He doesn't push anyone away, but we see him throughout cuddling up to the poor and the disenfranchised and the marginalized and the nobodies. And as Robert Farah Kaplan said, he said, he's about the least, the last, the lost, the little, and the dead. That's who Jesus is about. Jesus' own life reflected marginalization. And in our text, he's talking about a barn builder who thought he was a somebody but was a nobody. Why? Because he had failed to fall in love with the way of the gospel, the heart of God. Jesus, who was rich, became poor so we might become rich. This is not just some spiritual principle. It's rooted in the heart of the love and life of God in Jesus Christ. An insight into our economic injustice and the power of wealth to destroy is given in Karl Barth's great sermon. I was talking to Walter Brueggemann, I mentioned him, the guy who died, at a conference at Whitworth about 8 years ago. And I said, have you ever read, because he loves Barth, and it was about stuff he was talking on the sinking of the Titanic, his message on the sinking of the Titanic. Karl Barth, that was the title of his sermon, a week after the Titanic went down. I'm going to read to you from that sermon. The captain did not just have the safety of his passengers to think about, but also the commission he had been given by the shareholders who were employing him, the systemic power of money. To break the speed record, if he could, on the ship's first voyage. And it is because of this guilt that the Titanic went under, along with 1,500 human beings. And it is on this guilt which ran the Titanic into the iceberg that we must now reflect. On this great money-making operation. It is they, the captain and the sailors, who place the safety of 2,200 lives beneath their desire to compete with other companies. Think of that. For the sake of their dividends, they have 1,500 dead people on their conscience, but ultimately, not even this shipping company bears all the guilt for this disaster. But first and foremost, it is the system of acquisition by which thousands of companies like this one are getting rich today, not only through shipping, but across the whole spectrum of human labor. Bart spent so much of his time in his first pastorate working for human laborer rights. And then he says this: in yesterday's newspaper, the sinking of the Titanic was referred to as a crime of capitalism. And you know what he said? I can only agree. Capitalism is based on this principle: feed the greed of the people and it will create a public wealth. It's based on greed. John Locke. Why do you think Jesus talks so much about greed? Money. I want you to know, you're going to go home to a house, and we'll call it our house, but you don't own it. You own nothing. I own nothing. The world is the Lord's and everything in it. Psalm 24. Jesus did not live to surround his life with material acquisitions. When I look at Jesus' life, I am confronted with the opposite of me in my life. I'm speaking to me. Jesus was born in a borrowed barn and laid to rest in a borrowed tomb. And in between birth and death, he said, the Son of Man has nowhere to put his head. The question for me and the question for you is, do we love that Jesus? The Jesus who reveals to us the image of God? Or have we created our God in the image we want him to be? That's the message of this story, this parable. And it's really uncomfortable. I'm sorry, but I say this all in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit.